Hi, Arun. Welcome to AIX FM.
Hey, I'm super happy to be here.
Yeah. The last time we had a chat, you know when it was?
Oh, my God. Must be like 2 decades ago, something like that. Weird.
Yeah, almost. Okay, the last time we saw each other was the Kubernetes conference in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
With Star Wars experience.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah, this one. And then before was 2 decades again. And we had a chat about the Docker on my channel. So it's like, let's talk about Docker. This was a screencast about what is Docker, why it's important for microservices.
And that I remember very clearly because that literally was in the very early days of containers, Docker, microservices, mm-hmm. all of that. And how did the two connect? And that's when I just got excited about okay, this is a real deal. So yeah, mm-hmm. I remember that very well.
Very good. But now back to the serious stuff. What was your first computer?
Ooh, that was 386. It was a 4 MB RAM.
Wow, they are that young. I think you are way older than me. But you started like you know,
Yeah.
That's cool.
4 MB RAM, 200 MB hard disk, something like that. Yeah, it was my first computer.
And this was your first computer you own or you used, actually?
Both ways, you know, because back when I was doing master's is when I first touched the computers. And even in the department, we had machines like that in the Department of Computer Science where I was. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up buying a similar machine for myself back in the day from gray market, so to say. Because, you know, if you buy it from a commercial manufacturer, they were super expensive. Mm-hmm. So I kind of assembled that machine and got mm-hmm. that going. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty geeky experience.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. So I had, my true PC, the first one was Pentium 66. Mm. But before that, I had a long time ago, it was like a gap, but I started with ZX Spectrum. So I had a small. So I actually stunned that you didn't have, you know, like how to call it. What was ZX Spectrum? Not a personal computer, rather than a toy computer, maybe.
Yeah.
No experiences with C64 or ZX Spectrum. Nothing.
No. I just jumped straight into Pentium 386. Prior to that,
so what you did? You spent time on surfing on the beaches or what? As a kid.
Well, so I was about to comment that because my undergrad was in electronics. And in electronics, we did play around with the 8086 chips, you know, on a motherboard. So we would play around, muck around with those simple LED lights. Yeah. But that was about it. You know, when I got into the masters for computers, I was like, oh, dang it. You know, I got into masters. Now I need to learn about computers. And that's sort of how the whole thing started.
Yeah, this is the really fascinating story because, that you started, you know, with building a computer basically, and then it was excited to getting one. So, cool one.
Yeah. No, I'm very excited.
What you did with the computer? What is your first action? Usually, you know, my guests telling me they are playing games. I guess in your case, you did something serious. So I'm already curious.
No. Very, very much, you know, the first thing was, okay, and this is what friends teach you, right? That you got a computer, this computer can play BASIC, and in the BASIC, the first thing you do is you play the game of Snake.
Okay.
So I spent countless hours playing Snake, configuring my modem at that point of time, jumping onto the bulletin boards, following the chats, participating in the rooms. So that's sort of where I spent a lot of time. And of course, the college also needed mm-hmm. some Pascal work to be done. So I did a bit of a Pascal coding on that, mm-hmm. C coding on that. So I enjoyed that part of it for sure.
Yeah, and you enjoyed that? And what was... So you learned C, Pascal, and then what was the next language?
COBOL. So I think C, Pascal, and COBOL is what I learned in the early college days. Mm-hmm. And then after college, when I graduated out of college, right about then is when Java was launched. So my first job really required me to play in Java.
Wow.
And even my internship during master's, you know, I played a little bit with Java because this was an early 96 time frame. Mm-hmm. Java was brand new that time. It's like, oh, what is this cool language? You know,
But how you got hold on Java? Someone mentioned that because, I mean, it was like a parallel world, right? If you did something C++ and Java, Usually it happens if you had Sun hardware, you know, there was the link because someone mentioned Java and this was what happened, right?
Well, with Java, with early on, it was about that Vora concept, right? Once run anywhere kind of a thing from the very beginning itself. So I think I was working at this government organization back in Delhi, and those computers were pretty powerful. So that's where I get to at least try my simple ping pong games, you know, Hello World with Java, that what is this thing about? And then as soon as I joined in, my boss said, hey, you know, here is this applet you need to make. And that applet needs to talk to our database and get that party going. I was like, oh, whoa, from the ping pong game, how do I figure out the JDBC connection, applet sandbox and all those things? So that was quite an interesting experience, frankly.
Yeah, you are right. The applets and JDBC. This was like how to build a fat client, right? So back then it was, because the cores was still, so you were only able to connect, I remember, the servers from which you were loaded, right? This was the first. And then what I did, something similar, I bridged JDBC with RMI. You know, this was the first idea that there was like kind of I have remote procedure call and JDBC was on the server.
Well, and that's the funny part because, you know, after my first couple of jobs for a short time, then I applied, I came to US and in the US, I applied to sun.com/jobs and my then manager at that point of time called me that, hey, Arun, would you like for the JDK team? I was like, the JDK team? So yeah, come work for us. And then I got interviewed. My first job was actually RMI Korba test engineer. So I'm intimately familiar with the internals of RMI Korba, IDLJ compiler, RMIC compiler, how RMI works over JRMP or IIOP. So all of that was intricate level of details, which was my daily life back at Sun. So, I mean, I've lived that time quite well.
I didn't knew that. I thought, you know, you are like a marketing guy selling glassfish back then, you know. But I had no idea that you worked for the JDK team back then, I think.
No. I did the RMI Korba testing deep. You know, I used to read the specs quite intently. What does ORB do? You know, where does POA fit in? All of that concept.
Portable object adapter. Exactly.
I'm glad you remember that. Yeah, exactly. So that's something I used to kind of geek out every day with the people who were building the Korba stack in JDK at that point of time. So that was quite an exciting experience. And then from there, you know, when I joined Sun, the first gig really was, oh, we are doing this J2EE thing. And there was no 1.0 because 1.0 got delayed. So we did, first release was 1.2. So I joined, March?
Back to Korba and RMI, because this is an interesting experience. First, unpopular opinion, but I really like RMI. So RMI was just great. You remember naming dot lookup? And you had an interface, and you got the implementation of the interface back, which was dynamic proxy, and you were done. So this was the easiest possible way to have remote procedure call. Still great. And why it's relevant? Because in JavaScript space right now, they found, you know, about remote procedure call. And they are really excited about procedure call, which for me is funny. Because back then they said, okay, remote procedure call is binary. It is not like business-like. You're just invoking methods. 10 years later, just used to know REST and HTTP, remember the hysteria, and now we have it. And the JavaScript people are no more that excited about REST. They tried, you know, the GraphQL. So, okay, it is also complicated. And now full circle, and now they found about RMI. And I say, okay, that is actually cool. If I kept going, you know, with RMI all the 20 years, now I will be back in the hype cycle again, right? So this is interesting. And Korba, back to Korba, I like also Korba, but the problem was it's not as convenient as RMI from the developer perspective. You know, there was too many steps. You had to look up the naming service, you had the naming service, then you can call the backend. But what's also fascinating, this gRPC gets really popular And for me, it looks like Korba. So this is actually strange, you know. So that's actually, if you rename things and do a little bit, you know, a different website around that, it becomes popular.
Well, that's the one way to put it. But I think if I remember correctly, at that point of time, for example, we were using RMI over IIOP, and that would give us some level of language interoperability because RMI JRMP was exclusively Java. Then you give RMI IIOP, and IIOP was, you know, language independent. So you could talk to other languages that could understand the IIOP protocol. And that's the advantage that Korba also gave you, right? That when you do RMI IIOP, you can, the programming protocol is RMI, but on-the-wire protocol was IIOP. So I think that was a big advantage and how it allowed you to interoperate with other languages. And I think I remember writing simple C code even at that point of time that, okay, let me write a C IIOP server and see how that works. Because end of the day, the thing that we were striving heavily on is how do we make Java work out of the box with other languages that exist? Because end of the day, customer is going to download. The customer empathy is critical over there, right? So you download Java, you download C, you write applications in that. So one of the big things that we did, but even back, you know, even during J2E, Java E days, is we did app-centric testing because we were thinking about how the developers are going to think about the application. And then we write those applications and then make sure they are working. And in the process, as a Korba RMI test engineer, we'll find out, aha, these are the simple RMI IIOP bugs or Korba bugs that are in the stack, and then file those bugs to make sure this providing out-of-the-box streamlined developer experience for the customer.
Yeah, and they were actually great times. If you think about this, this was absolutely, it worked. So I used this all the time. In most cases, what not necessary. So what I thought back then, I remember, is, okay, why we need a Korba in between if we... with Java's everywhere, you know? In my projects, there was Java, 100% Java. So there was no C in place. So, okay, come on with Korba. We can just use RMI. It would be way better. And there were servers, Orion server back then, which were RMI-based, and then they had to use Korba because of the J2E standard. But maybe it was, you know, too compatible back then. I would say if we would make, you know, RMI more convenient, even more convenient, because there are some, I remember there are some scalability problems with garbage collection, you know, back then with RMI, because it had to, you know, to poll the server, I'm alive. But we could actually invert that. So there would be inversion of control could also work. We could learn from Genie. Back, you remember Genie, actually?
Oh, my God. Yeah, very well do. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that I miss about Sun is, not miss, rather, it's my pet peeve, that Sun had this technology curve, technology arc before anybody else in the industry could think of. We had this Genie, you know, with the, we had this RMI IIOP, we had SunGrid way back in 2006. You know, this is right about the time when AWS was coming up.
Yeah, exactly.
So this was, I remember back in the Sun campuses in Santa Clara, we were talking about $1 an hour of computing. You know, we just couldn't execute on that part of it. So I think that was, you know, otherwise Sun would have been a very different story. You know, today Oracle has acquired Sun, but, you know, who knows what it would have been, you know, if Sun would have gone full force on that route.
Yeah, and SunGrid was the first cloud attempt. It was a little, from the convenience perspective, I remember, because I it was a little bit strange because you had to submit a zip. And I said, come on, zip. Why not an ear? No, if you would submit an application server business logic, it would be serverless, you know, 20 years before serverless even occurred. So for me, it was like, I say, hey, come on, son. Now we have everything. Why do I have to, you know, to ship everything? We could just ship the business application. Now we are talking. And this would be, you know, before App Engine, before anything else. And they just didn't got the last mile. So the last mile was always missing. Yeah. So this was sad story. And maybe there was not too much fight between departments inside Sun. So the SunGrid didn't want it to work together with J2E department or whatever. So this is what I can imagine back then. Because in one part of time it happened, and you were also aware of that. So what I found out, Glassfish, there was a GMS provider. And at the same time, they had a department at Sun Microsystem which worked on gaming, real-time gaming. And they also had started to implement a messaging service. And I asked them, you know, why not on Glassfish? And they could, yeah, because the JMS is not scalable. It's like, what do you mean the JMS is not scalable? It's just an API. I mean, an interface is as scalable as an interface can be. I mean, you know, who cares? And they just didn't want it to use. They wanted to implement their own solution. So this was politics a little bit as well. Yeah.
And I've seen that NIH syndrome, you know, over the last 25 odd years, mm-hmm. I've moved around multiple companies. And I've seen that NIH syndrome so prominent that, oh, you know what? I didn't invent it, so I can't trust that solution. I'm mm-hmm. going to create my own because I think we can do it better. We mm-hmm. are different. We are a snowflake. That's usually never the case.
Exactly.
You know, 80% of your needs can usually be met by mm-hmm. other person's project. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you put 20% effort, and you can only make it bigger. And that's sort of the open source ethos in general, mm-hmm. that don't start something of your own. If you can get 80% done, build on top of that, add your few features into that project and make the overall project much bigger. So that's mm-hmm. a bit challenge, but that's nothing about technology. That's frankly all about humans.
Yeah. And for me, Git is even a step further. So what the company does is one thing, but what I'm interested in is a kind of a standard. You know, if J2E, serverless, whatever, this was for me a standard. And I say, okay, I will never accept a proprietary solution if servlets are in place, for instance. You know, why I should use something strange? If serverless is clearly documented, everyone knows servlets, so just go with servlets and provide a layer on top of that. And if this is not enough, try to extend servlets. So at least send an email and say, okay, this is at least you can do. But I think outside of companies, so like consultants, for them, this is boring, you know? As a consultant, you always try to do something which is unique to show off. Because, no, right now, I would, for instance, absolutely go to conference and tell about serverless because almost forgotten. But usually, you are searching a new language or whatever, some, you know, space technology to show off at conferences, which is a little bit of problem as well, right?
Well, and I think that's the dichotomy between, you know, you as a consultant versus you as a conference speaker, right?
Yeah.
Because as a consultant, you got to do things that kind of gets your money paid, that gets your bill paid. But at a conference speaker, people don't want to hear about old technologies. They only want to hear about the latest and the greatest technology.
Yeah.
Oh, servlet is so old school. I know all of this. Tell me what is happening in servlet.next or whatever that looks
yeah,
like. So I
exactly.
think that's always the case. So I hear you. I hear you and I agree. That is exactly what I've seen all along.
The coolest story, this is old one, so I can tell it. So you know the JAX conference in Germany?
I do.
And yeah. And there was a session like Enterprise Ruby on Rails or something. And after the session, I went to the speaker and asked, hey, do you have a projects with Ruby actually? Because I never saw this in the wild. And he says, no, you know, it's just fun. I do it on the weekends. During the week, I'm working on J2E. And I say, okay, but at least you have to say it. Otherwise, it's the impression that, you know, J2E is dead and everyone does Ruby on Rails. And this was the funniest story ever, you know. Because
awesome.
Sometimes I was at conferences, I was listening because I cannot believe they are actually using this. I never saw a German company using this, right? So, and then I asked them, like, no, you know, it is not used in practice, but this is a great talk. I sell the talk at conferences. Like, okay, this is okay. At least say this, right? Because otherwise,
yeah. Well,
but,
and I think that is exactly what is highlighting our dichotomy that, you know, mm-hmm. if I give a talk on J2E, see, think about 2010, right? 2006, 7, 8 time frame. If you want to give a talk about J2E versus Ruby on Rails, what is hotter? What is the likelihood that the program committee, I think the whole system in that sense, if I think about it, to be a bit cynical, is a bit rigged because the program committee want to select the latest papers. Mm-hmm. The conference organizers want to attract attendees. Mm-hmm. So, and the attendees also want to go to the conference to talk to these top-notch speakers with the latest topics mm-hmm. because everything else is already available on the internet. So I think the whole system is a bit rigged in that sense mm-hmm. with a bias towards later topics as opposed to like existing topics.
Mm-hmm. You're right. So, but we covered SunGrid, and after SunGrid, there was the SunCloud. There was another attempt, and what was really great about that, I don't know you're aware for that about that for sure. It was briefly before Oracle bought Sun, so it was never released. But the APIs were available on internet, you know,
I
the RESTful,
that.
And they were great. They were great. Yeah. This was like, you know, you could go and say, create a server. You got back the server and you can proceed with MySQL database. So I used that to explain RESTful on conferences. Say, look, there is a Sun REST API. It is really RESTful. If you ask me what is RESTful API, this is great. And I even have some screenshots because before they killed that, because it was absolutely stunning how well executed it was. And this was created by the XML guy who works now at Google. I forgot his name, but he invented XML and he was really into this. You know?
Tim Bray.
Exactly. Tim Bray did it.
And I remember giving feedback to Tim about cloud.sun.com. That was the domain.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And the REST API and all. So I played with it. And that was, you're right, that was a very good way of, you know, showing up. And I remember putting up Wireshark in the picture. Mm-hmm. Let me show you what the actual wire dump looked like. Here is what the REST request looks like. So I think it was a very classic. So I think that kind of goes back to the pet peeve I was saying earlier. Sun had all these things figured out. It's always that last mile problem, the execution problem is what took us down. But hey, you know what? I had a great time, learned a lot of good technology, built a lot of lifelong friends over there. So no regrets at all.
Yeah. So you spent the time at with J2E then, and then Glassfish. Was it the same department or different? So, you know, what would be interesting? So how you switched from Corba to J2E? So what happened internally?
So I was always part of the same team all along, pretty much, right? So I was always part of the J2E, Java EE team. Mm-hmm. And the way it was is the Corba functionality was built really in the J2E team because that's where the primary consumer was. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, over a period of time, we realized that Corba needs to move into the base JDK. Mm-hmm. So then we started working closely with the JDK team as well, and we started integrating over there. And over a period of time, that became more and more of a trend. So, for example, I worked on Jax B testing. Jax B kind of moved into JDK as well. I worked on Jax RS, you know, so Jax RS kind of moved in there. At one point, we had this JWSDP, Java Web Services Developer Pack. So I was leading the testing effort for that. And pretty much most of those technologies kind of got baked into JDK. So we would craft these technologies as packs or as in J2EE APIs. But over a period of time, we recognized that these APIs are a lot more heavily used by the other Java users as well. So it's not fair for, at that time, we used to have this Java SE, mm-hmm. Java EE, and Java ME. So for Java SE folks to use those APIs, they have to do some crooked ways, either import those APIs or download the J2EE profile, whatever that needs to be done. So to simplify that entire process, we started integrating those APIs smack into J2SE itself, the Java SE platform itself. And that's sort of where we interacted very closely with the Java platform, that how we're going to make this work. And then whatever tests we would write, we would run those tests on the J2EE platform and the Java SE platform as well.
Mm-hmm. And then you switched to Glassfish team, right? Because this is where we met, really. So at least because I use Glassfish a lot in all my projects, and I attended Java once, I think. I started 2006, 2007, where I was able to speak. And this is also where you became, I think, the Glassfish evangelist, right?
I was. So I think I'm thinking about the timeline. Was it J2E 1.3, 1.4 timeframe? I think it's 1.4 timeframe when Glassfish became the reference implementation.
Mm-hmm.
And then Java
Before
E5.
That, I used the Sun Java reference implementation. You know the
exactly
with
exactly.
the RM, with the Swing app with where you right. can deploy exactly.
Uh-huh. Right.
And you were so also think, who built that? Who built actually the first one? You were also it was your department.
Yeah. So I mean, I was part of. So when I joined back in March of 1999, the alpha release of J2E 1.2 happened in April. So I was part of the J2E team from the very beginning itself. You know, we did alpha, beta, and the GA release happened, I believe, in September, October at Java 1 that year in 99. Mm-hmm. So I was part of that entire release cycle. But initially, it was a closed source reference implementation. And around 2002-03 timeframe is when we took that entire closed source reference implementation to open source reference implementation. Mm-hmm. And that's when it became Glassfish. Mm-hmm. So that's where we had glassfish.dev.java.net. So that entire 2 to 3 year journey where we took Glassfish downloads from 0 to 5 million in 3 years, mm-hmm. that's one. Second is changing that company culture that, hey, what does it mean to build a closed source app server versus an open source app server? Because closed source app server, you can have the water cooler discussions, but the teams were again spread across East Coast, West Coast. So Burlington was one big campus and Santa Clara was one big campus. And there were folks scattered all around the world as well. So how do you communicate across those people in a closed environment? But now think about doing this in an open environment. And open environment, people are literally all around the world. Mm-hmm. So building that open source culture is where I got excited about the broader open source mentality, thought process, culture part of it. And I never looked back. Now I've always worked in open source, gosh, for over 20 years now. And I even wrote a book last couple of years ago, Fostering Open Source Culture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my early lessons really come from the Glassfish days. And
the title is Fostering Open Source, the title of the book.
No, the title of my book is Fostering Open Source Culture. Fostering Open Source. And in that book, basically, see, because after Sun, I've gone through a bunch of companies, you know, Red Hat, Couchbase, Amazon,
but
Apple.
You've wrote another book, which was, I guess, far more popular, right? You know which book I mean?
Oh, the Minecraft one?
Yeah, exactly.
that one still sell copies. After 12 years,
yeah,
people still buy that. They love it. They love that copy. And that is indeed my most favorite book, you know, of the 7 books I've written. That book is very special to me because I wrote that book with my son.
Mm-hmm. And your son was the youngest speaker at Java 1, I guess.
He was. You know, we wrote that book when he was 11 years of age. Mm-hmm. And the book was released when 11 years old. But at age 10, he gave a keynote at Java 1.
Exactly.
And he talked about when pigs fly.
So, exactly.
You know, he showed flying pigs. Yeah. In Minecraft, and he coded that mod, and it was pretty awesome.
And they exploded. So what I remember, he said, "No, we can you can tune the dynamite or whatever, and the explosion is bigger." For Java 1 back then was a big thing, such a thing, because it was serious. You know, right now it is more loose, but back then it was actually amazing. So everyone loved that.
Yeah. No, I think that's the energy that I've always tried to put in. You know, how do we bring more kids to technology? How do we do more fun things with technology and enable younger kids? With now the way industry is evolving, anybody and everybody is able to kind of craft some fun applications. Mm-hmm. But yeah, back then, like, you know, I'm talking about 10, 12 years ago, it was a different landscape where technology was not easily accessible, definitely not to kids. Mm-hmm. And that's when Stefan Janssen, the founder of DevOps, he started the DevOps for Kids. Uh-huh. So I got that motion to US. Uh-huh. And we ran, some 200 plus workshops across US, taught about 5,000 plus kids, you know, on a variety of workshops, Minecraft modding, and that was primarily Java, Raspberry Pi, Python, all sorts of stuff, you know, Sonic Pi, Ruby, uh-huh. All sorts of different languages we taught kids.
And Stefan was already on the podcast, and he is really crazy because he can do whatever he likes, but he still codes like crazy. This is what I admire, you know, because the entire conference system is implemented by him, which kudos to him because, you know, he has the experience from the field and knows where the conference should go. So I think it's a really great idea or
well, attitude. And I think, mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I highly respect that thing about him. And I think that brings a lot of credibility to him because he knows what he's talking about. And the kind of conference he runs, you know, as DevOps and other DevOpses, he could go deep into the technology with any of the speakers in that sense. Mm-hmm. So I think if you money is no constraint and you can mm-hmm. do a fun thing and you're still doing coding, that means you really love it.
Exactly. And it speaks also about your attitude, you know, because, okay, I don't like, you know, to give up and buy whatever, an island or an yacht. And instead, you know, I'm doing something and learn, still keep learning, even if I don't have to. So this is what I like, you know, just keep learning.
I love it.
Yeah.
And this kind of goes back to the philosophy that Steve Jobs actually said, you know, stay hungry, stay foolish.
Exactly.
You know, so if you are not hungry, if you are not staying foolish, not asking the right questions, not having that genuine curiosity in your mind, learning stops happening. And then when learning stops happening, you stop growing.
And fun ends, you know, because I think to having fun, you need a challenge. Without a challenge, no fun.
As an athlete, I always talk about that the only time growth happens when you're uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And the uncomfortable feeling, you need to get comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
That it's okay to be uncomfortable, but then you ask around, you figure your way out, you know, you talk to people, and then that's when the growth happens, because that's when you're learning new skill.
Yeah. And then if the uncomfortable becomes comfortable, you need the new uncomfortable. Otherwise...
Always. You know, I mean, change is the only constant. Change is the only constant, period.
Yeah.
I mean, I was listening to a podcast and I really, really connect with that. It says, keeping calmly, knowing change. Mm-hmm. Four words. And it says, it summarizes the entire Buddhist philosophy, the monk philosophy. Keeping means you continue the work.
Mm-hmm.
Calmly means you accept it.
Mm-hmm.
No judgment. Knowing means it is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And change means change is the only constant. So keeping calmly, knowing change, because change is happening all around us, right? Mm-hmm. My baggage got delayed. My flight got delayed. I didn't have my right breakfast today. Whatever, right? You know, a lot of different things. Things show up 5 minutes late, 10 minutes late, an hour late. So how do you adapt to that change? And particularly if you contextualize it in the today's world, there are so many coding agents. One, every week there is a new coding agent coming up and some other coding agent is getting better. Some other coding agent is slopping.
I have to re-invite you back to talk about more this stuff, because otherwise we will talk about 4 hours today, I suspect, you know.
This is I agree. But this is something close to my heart.
To my as well. So this is a dangerous topic. So cover a bit. So what I'm just interesting was the J2E reference implementation, and then Glassfish happened. Yeah. And I remember the Glassfish 1 was not that usable. And then V2 happened, which was highly reusable. And there was a huge refactoring going on. And it was actually unbelievably good at that time. And what was good about Glassfish was the first time I saw something at Sun Microsystems. And this was the usability. So it came out of the box with great console, with built-in monitoring, which was way better than competitors. So this was actually the unique story about Glassfish. And how I was able to sell Glassfish, or sell, I never got anything from Sun, but to sell means to introduce Glassfish in projects was how I introduced Glassfish. I say, look, this is the reference implementation. It works great. This is open source. And if you like, you can still buy support. And this combination was unique, right?
And I think the time in which you were doing that, nobody had, that model was not prominent, that open source and a support. Now it's a very standard model.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're talking about 15 years ago. You're telling people that open source, free to download, free to try, no time bomb,
mm-hmm.
but this becomes mission critical for you and you need one throat to choke. You get that,
mm-hmm.
you know, with a minimal cost. And I think the scale is amazing. And I also remember, I think you mentioned a very important point here, from V1 to V2, if I remember correctly, the biggest change was OSGI. You know, mm-hmm. We made entire Glassfish modular.
This was V2 and V3. V3 was the OSGI DV1.
Oh, V3 was OSGI. Yeah.
And V3 was the jar, you know, single jar. You had at conferences, jar minus jar, Glassfish dot jar. Java minus jar, Glassfish dot jar, which back then was crazy. It's like Quarkus right now. So
Exactly. So, and I think that OSGI was a game changer for us as well, because I remember every technology in the stack had to be OSGI compatible. We were starting to write the interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of that was because it was OSGI, because it was modular, you know, people could start writing their own modules mm-hmm. on top of Glassfish and drop it into the directory. Mm-hmm. And if you're following the OSGI format, who was the guy? Neil Tyson? There's an OSGI guy.
Yeah, yeah. But he was not at Sun, right?
No, he was not at Sun.
Yeah.
But I was interacting with him quite a bit for the OSGI spec, essentially, that as we are writing this OSGI module, does it align? Does it not align? I myself wrote a bunch of, you know, because as an evangelist, if you want to explain the OSGI architecture, you need to understand it. So I was understanding that architecture myself, writing blogs about it. And of course, he would comment on those blogs. So I remember writing a simple plugin for the Glassfish console that you talked about. And in that Glassfish console, essentially, I built a simple animation. You know, as you are making request, I built a simple Glassfish that will float up and down the ocean, mimicking your request, how many number of requests that are being coming up. So I think it's, and even the console, the Glassfish backend has a REST API by which you can query and interact, you know, what's going on. So that entire REST model, that entire API first model, that entire modular architecture was very unique back 15 years ago. And I had a lot of learning as part of that. So very, very grateful in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And then you left Oracle in one point of time. When was it?
That was about 2013 is when I left Oracle.
Mm-hmm. But but you stay until 2013 with the Glassfish team? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So pretty much 99 to 2013, I was part of the Glassfish team all along.
And you had a great blog. It's like Miles to Go, right? Was it?
I had a great blog, Miles to Go. And that is still my life's mantra in terms of Miles to Go. You know, I like to run. I run pretty much 4 or 5 days a week.
Wow.
And this morning I had it's a beautiful weather here in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
I ran by Amstel Park, you know, 10K run. Very good.
10K so kilometers or 10K miles?
10 kilometers. Yeah, 10 kilometers. Yeah.
10 kilometers. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very manageable distance, you know, gets you a little bit of the comfort zone. And I've been doing that for a while now.
Okay. So also good, you know, to keep mind clear, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. I think for the longest time, I always start my day with a workout in the morning. Mm-hmm. And by that workout, it is, you know, either a 10K run, you know, ish run, or like a trail run in the weekend, or like a couple of lifting sessions a week. Mm-hmm. But you start your day with that, and that clears up your mind.
Mouse lifting or, you know?
No. this is a MacBook, so I only have a trackpad here. But I have a full power cage in my house. Mm-hmm. So I got a barbell and the whole shebang, the full setup in my garage.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of days of that and the 4 or 5 days of running. And it keeps your mind clear, as you said, because during that time, I'm less thinking about work, but just staying in my own mind, because you need to be very present, particularly when you're lifting. Running is okay. Running, you can, you know, is a more repetitive motion, but lifting, you've got to really pay attention to your posture, to your focus, to your breathing. So you have to be really present in that moment. And what I've realized over the years is that mindfulness, because you start your day with a mindful activity, that mindfulness carries throughout the day in that sense.
Yeah, this is what I can imagine. Because, And what happened after Sun?
So after Sun, actually, during Sun time, Red Hat, you know, at Sun, we used to have Glassfish. At Red Hat had JBoss.
Mm-hmm.
So Red Hat had reached out to me a few times that, hey, Arun, join us. And then the third time when they reached out to me, they said, hey, you know what? We have made you offer multiple times. You have rejected every time. Why? Well, you're trying to buy a Ferrari for a Hyundai price. It doesn't work like that. So it's like, what do you need? I need a title. I need a salary. I need a scope. I need an impact. So I kind of gave them my requirements. A couple of days later, they came back with an offer letter. And they said, yeah, whatever you're doing for Glassfish, do that for JBoss.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got a team. So I ran a team for technical marketing for JBoss at Red Hat. So I spent about a couple of years over there driving that technical marketing developer advocacy efforts over there.
I forgot about that. I remember this because we also were in touch at Red Hat and JBoss champions would send me, you know, stickers and whatever. I still have them. It's a lot of fun.
That's right. That's right.
And
that's the time that you and I recorded that Docker video. Red Hat time. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I did microservices all the time. And what I find out is that the application servers are actually great because the platform doesn't change. So I had a base layer with application server, and what I deployed was just the worst. And he told me, you know, application servers is like, maybe they work, maybe they don't. It's like, hey, Arun, I have to show you this. And then we recorded a video where I showed you this and said, oh my God, that. this works actually. And
And I think the beauty of, you know, at that time, if you think about it, we were deploying WARs and mm-hmm. we were encapsulating the WARs, you know, as a microservice mm-hmm. and making those WARs really talk to each other. But then the beauty of it was the moment you got to Docker, it allowed you to try out different languages. Mm-hmm. So you could still use, and by that time we had a lightweight Java EE reference implementation that mm-hmm. could be baked into the Docker container itself. Mm-hmm. So you have a very self-contained microservice in a Docker container, mm-hmm. and it doesn't matter whether you're using a WAR or a EAR or whatever you're using or a different language altogether, because mm-hmm. the new encapsulation layer was Docker in that case.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. After Red Hat, you were at Intel, right?
No, gosh, there was a long journey after that. So after Red Hat, I spent about 18 months at Couchbase. Mm-hmm. Then I spent a few years at Amazon. Then a couple of years at Apple.
You were at the Coreto team.
I was. I actually launched Coreto. So there was an engineering team. I mean, by the time I joined Amazon, the idea was, hey, we're building a Kubernetes service. So I made Amazon join CNCF. So that mm-hmm. happened. That was pretty exciting. And then my next gig was, okay, hey, we're going to launch Coreto. And you're a Java champion. You know the Java folks really well.
Who came up with the name Coreto? Was your idea?
We had a deeper discussion. We had a lot of name. And naming is one of the hardest problems in computer science, right? So we had a deeper discussion. All of us gave our suggestions. And then we kind of figured out, you know, what that name is going to look like. I think it was Yishai and I who were going back and forth. Yishai was the engineering manager at that point of time. We went back and forth multiple times on what that name is going to look like, what the legal is going to approve. Finally, we got that name approved. And I remember 2019. 2019 is when we went to DevOps Belgium. Mm-hmm. I think that's the time James Gosling was also at Amazon. So we took mm-hmm. James Gosling with us to DevOps Belgium and let him announce Amazon Coreto mm-hmm. at DevOps.
Yeah.
So I remember James getting up there on the stage. We hid him through the back door. We got him into the DevOps keynote, surprise entry. And then he gets up onto the stage. He's wearing a Coreto shirt. He takes his jacket off. I am the father of Java, and I am announcing Coreto. It's a lot of fun around that. We built a lot of good community around it.
What I remember is as you joined AWS, I asked you, what's wrong with you? So you had a great, you know, great things with Java, and now you're on AWS. And you told me, yeah, because we are creating Java at AWS. Okay, that's cool. And I asked you, what's Coreto? And you told me, I remember, it's like coffee with liquor or something like this, right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, cool name.
I remember that. I completely forgot about that, but now you're reminding me. That is exactly what Coreto is. It's coffee with liquor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you what you did at AWS? You exactly. So I mean, it was like marketing around Coreto.
No. So AWS, I was a principal open source technologist. Mm-hmm. You know, this is going back to 2017 days when AWS did not know how to do open source at all. Mm-hmm. So when I joined Amazon, they were saying, "Hey, we launched Kubernetes." I said, "Oh, that's great, but how do you contribute to Kubernetes? Why do we contribute to Kubernetes kind of thing? Why mm-hmm. do we need to?" Mm-hmm. So kind of building that open source muscle that, no, you must join CNCF and things like that. And similarly, when we're launching Coreto, how do we engage with the community? How mm-hmm. do we do that? I mean, Amazon is a big player, was a big player, still a big player. How do you walk into the community in a humble way, connected way, grounded way? So as a principal open source technologist, I was on loan to multiple service teams across the company mm-hmm. and crafting their open source strategies on how mm-hmm. do you engage with community, how do you reach out to developers, which conferences where you go out to. So I think mm-hmm. it was more of a very community-centric role, but very open source-centric role too. So that's why the title was very appropriate, principal open source technologist.
Okay, I can imagine hard job, right? Because this was, I think, not a fun.
Not a fun, but I think I really enjoyed it. You know, if it's a, we were talking about this earlier, right? growth only happens when you are uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So really, I had to apply all my open source knowledge together and make Amazon a better open source citizen. And you can see today in all the work that has been done, not just by me, but many people after me, on how Amazon is a little bit better respected in the open source space. So I think I'm excited and proud of that work.
Yeah, they are not, it from outside, no one believes AWS does open source, but if they contribute to the project, they do it right. So actually, so then I took a look, you know, and they do crazy stuff like Lucene, you know, Lucene, yeah. They contribute to Lucene. And had a talk, you know, with the Lucene people. It's like, this is actually great. They behave. They're really good citizens, which is, so this is actually how they contribute is good. And I'd also have had a chat, you know, with some people at AWS. It's like, okay, we would like to contribute, but if we contribute, we would like to do it right. You know, this is the thing. So sometimes they say, we have no idea how to do it right now, but if we do, we do it right, which is a great attitude, actually, right? So this is
yeah, because one of the things that Amazon really lives by is leadership principles. Mm-hmm. And one of the leadership principles is customer obsession. Mm-hmm. So even if they are contributing to a project, not for the fun of it, but because customers want it to work at Amazon scale, mm-hmm. so they would contribute features that aligns the project on how you can run it in a scalable manner on as an AWS service, mm-hmm. because those scalability concerns are massive. You know, I mean, imagine running an open source project as an AWS service, the kind of operational details that you need. And yes, there is a control plane, but then the data plane is where the open source project is running. So mm-hmm. How do you create the abstraction in the data plane so that control plane can tap into that, or the touch points that they would usually build? But more recently, they have started owning features, which is great because that's the way, that's the right way, as you said, you know, chop wood, carry water. You cannot be just exclusively doing stuff that is very selfish to you, but, you know, overall lifting and elevating the overall project too.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you're aware of, but the Amazon Coretta was at least the most popular JDK, open JDK distribution on Earth. Recently.
I remember that. No, I know very well, you know, about that because I've stayed in touch with the Coretta team. And the reason I know that is because after Amazon, I went and worked for Apple. And mm-hmm. at Apple.
Ah, yeah. This is even more interesting what you did at Apple.
Quite exciting. So at Apple, they brought me in to craft their open source strategy. Mm-hmm. So I founded their open source program office. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, one of the teams I was managing was the Apple JDK team. So Apple does not contribute to OpenJDK. So they would fork it and they would maintain it internally.
What is the name of the JDK internal?
Apple JDK.
Apple JDK, okay.
Apple JDK, very simple. Okay. So I managed that team and we would work with our stakeholders across the company, whether it's Apple Music, whether it's Siri. Oh, mm-hmm. My blinds are coming down. So
no problem.
No matter what team it is, they were using Apple JDK. And in that case, we were able to provide them the Apple JDK releases on a regular cadence mm-hmm. so that they could be more effective.
So is Java used a lot inside Apple?
All over. All over.
Really?
I mean, on your phone, any of the services that you see, they're most likely using a Java backend.
Yeah, this is crazy, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, it is crazy. And Java is running at a massive scale. So, I mean, I've heard that news that Java is dead. This is exaggerated. I've heard that for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And Java is very much prominent and thriving in the enterprise.
Yeah. So after Apple, so were you successful at Apple or kind of successful? Or
I would say I like working with external communities. I like being visible in the community. And Apple has a different culture where they do not, or they hold you back mm-hmm. in terms of a lot of external engagements that you want to do, because they say you come to Apple to do the best work for Apple. Within Apple, you can thrive really well, but it did not align very well with my own aspirations mm-hmm. because for me, you know, I really thrive on interacting with people outside the company, inside the company, connecting both of them likewise. So that's the beauty that I really enjoyed. But within a couple of years, it was quite evident that it's not going to work out very well. So in the meanwhile, Intel reached out and they said, yeah, come work for us. I said, this is awesome, actually. So, and Intel is a company that I've always respected for doing open source contributions.
There were also a lot of Java 1 appearances always, you know, that always Java 1 keynotes and how they integrate with Java optimizations. So they were actually integral part of Java ecosystem always.
Exactly. So I think with a high respect for entire company for open source contribution, I joined there as a VP of open ecosystem and really building that entire developer marketing function over there. So when I left, I was leading a large team of developer marketing across Intel for software part of it. And that was quite exciting.
And you, so you were a similar story. You tried to foster open source a little bit more, less technical, more like marketing, right?
No, actually the open source culture was already quite prevalent across the company. For me, it was more about, are we joining the right foundations? What are we getting out of the foundation? Okay. Are we showing up at the right events?
Strategist.
Are we doing the, very strategical role. Are we doing the right enablement workshop? Things like that. And if somebody does not understand the value of open source, how do we educate them? How do we enable them? Working a lot with academia. So all across the company, that was the standard function that my team was capable of.
And the next, and then you joined JetBrains, right?
Well, so July 31st was my last day at Intel because they decided they don't want to do anything to do with software. So most of the software team was let go. And July 31st was my last day. I was very fortunate, very, very blessed, very, very grateful on how JetBrains found me for this job. So I joined JetBrains October 1st, just a 2 months gap. And October 1st, I started at JetBrains as a VP of Developer Experience. So now I've been here for over 5 months. And it's pretty exciting because JetBrains is a strategic point at this point of their life. You know, they are a 26-year-old company now. They do developer tools, you know, pick a language, pick a stack. They support it and developers love it. We got about 300,000 plus customers, 15 million monthly active users. And my job is for all the IDEs, define their developer experience. And as part of that, I have multiple functions in my team, whether it's product marketing, developer advocacy, relationship with academy, enterprise growth, working with sales quite actively, or community marketing and partnership marketing, where we are working with our different partners and community members, community influencers, on how do we make that successful for us. So yeah, it's a very exciting role, very large charter, and I take that very responsibly and very actively.
What we should do, I should reinvite you back after you are a JetBrains senior, so after a few weeks, months, or whatever, and to talk a little bit deep about, you know, whatever tools JetBrains has, just, you know, freestyle JetBrains conversation.
We can
from
do that.
You, just from Java perspective, of course. And now you ask me, we had a two-sentence preparation before the show, and you ask me, you know, what I am doing, and just a short story, because I found something interesting. And so I stick with standards because I was lazy, maybe, or to learn stuff which will probably die. So, okay, if I focus on whatever standards there is, the stability, then I can do more fun stuff because, you know, the standards are boring anyway. So whether I use this dependency injection or CDI, I focus on CDI because everyone uses CDI. And I was lucky with Quarkus because Quarkus is hugely popular and Quarkus is used a lot also in serverless. So I did a lot of work on AWS with Quarkus serverless, and basically it was the same programming model like Glassfish. I did actually fun talks. I was an maybe you ever spoke at Cluj in Romania, Java user group?
I've spoken there once.
Yeah. I was there, and I wanted to hack something on stage with, I think, JBoss or Glassfish about Draculas, and they told me they hate Draculas. Just go liquor store. So I remember, you know, all the Romanian liquors like Zuica, and this is what I remember because it is the first letter is T. And I found that recently, and I migrated it to Quarkus, and it still runs. So this is the amazing story. And this is what my clients love it, because you can pick an old J2E system and modernize it And everyone is surprised how fast it goes. But this is not what I found something else. What Sun did back then, the strategy was vendor neutrality or product independence. So you can focus on the API, right?
Right.
They can swap the implementations.
Yeah.
And in order to achieve that, you are aware of it, there were JSRs, Java specification requests, which was the spec. There was the TCK, and there was the reference implementation. And everything was supposed to be open source. TCK not so, now it is, but back then not open source. But everything else was open source. And the specs, like JAX-RES, if you open JAX-RES spec, they are normative. It means they are written in very specific way. They are almost mathematic way, shall, must not, must, and so forth, right? And the interesting part is, because everything was open and is publicly available, LLMs know it by heart. So, and we missed each other at Focus. This is what talk I delivered at JFocus. High-speed Java development, it means if you know the words, the patterns from back then, you can have a three-word prompt and it generates great Java API which runs on Quarkus. Right. Why that is? Because the LLMs love normative APIs, and if they know it, there are no hallucinations. So actually, I've worked a lot with the stuff now, right now, and I showed... I try to do, you know, a presentation without slides. But it doesn't work. Because if I start, I show the audience how it works and say, what you are doing is impossible. Because you know how it can be. It's like, because Java is open source and LLMs are data hungry. So pick whatever LLMs you have and it will generate perfect code. So it means with Java and standards are back in the game.
Right.
Now, what I'm doing on top of the LLMs, because you mentioned agents, and I didn't want to tell you this because we were spoken of for hours. And what I do is, with a small skill on top of, or agents MD, on top of the usual agents, you can achieve remarkable stuff because you can just say, okay, only generate 3 tests, not 20. Write Java doc, meaningful Java doc, and please do not comment any getters and setters. Actually, what I preach for years, and with that, we have the unique opportunity to generate or to create better code faster than ever.
Right,
and the code is highly maintainable. And what I'm trying now right now is that the code is so good in Java. It encodes all the semantics that you can open it with whatever LLM you have, and you don't need any skills, no Claude MD, nothing. It just gets you what your intentions.
Yeah, yeah.
And this works beautifully. It means I think Java, if it is widely recognized, I think, should become even more popular because this is a unique feature of Java. I'm not aware of any other platform with open specifications which were written in that way, not even .NET. Yeah. They don't have it. And if you know the knowledge from the past, you can create extremely well-written APIs which are highly maintainable with focus on business. And this is what I'm working on right now.
We can talk about hours on this. I believe you. Adam, I got to run for my next meeting.
Yeah.
But boy, this has been an exciting conversation. I will.
Where people can find you?
Oh, they can find me LinkedIn. LinkedIn is the easiest place.
Uh-huh.
I sometimes hang out on X/Twitter. So Arun Gupta, one word.
Uh-huh.
Shoot me a mail if you want to talk to me, arun.gupta@jetbrains.com. Uh-huh. Plus arun.gupta@gmail.com, whatever works. So I'm easily accessible. I respond to messages. I'm on a bunch of community Slack channels as well. Arun Gupta, one word. So find me there. Lots of ways you can reach out to me.
Super cool. And see you next time we talk about JetBrains.
We will. Awesome. Thank you so much. Take care. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.